Welcome to Just Another Wine Podcast. My name is Doug Regg.
Jamie Good.
And I am Emily Harmon.
Lovely to meet you all. Well, it was pretty difficult to come up with a name, Just Another Wine Podcast. I keep on having to repeat it just to remind myself what we called it. Jamie, what do you think about that? Is it a good name?
I think it's a good name because actually, you know, when it comes to wine podcasts, there's quite a few around now and we had some really good ideas, but they're already taken. So this quest has led us to this slightly ironic title, which I think is quite good.
Yeah, there's a big grain of truth in that title. But we are another wine podcast out there.
Well, we're not going to try to be just another wine podcast. We're going to try to be a bit individual and quirky and funny, hopefully. Let's introduce each other and ourselves a bit more fully. So firstly, Jamie, tell us a bit about yourself, how you got into this mad world of wine and variations on that theme.
Who the hell are you?
I came into wine from the outside. So I was at Leicester University, so I stayed an extra 3 years to do a PhD in plant biology. Then I got a job working as a science editor, which is kind of interesting. So I spent 15 years immersed in different fields of science, hosting these small meetings with 25 top experts around the world on a particular subject. And so over these 15 years, I've travelled a bit. I got to deal with some really interesting scientists and I think became fairly scientifically literate in lots of different fields. But more to the point, I suddenly found I developed a wine habit. I got into wine and wine kind of grabs you sometimes and it certainly did for me. And it got to the stage that when the internet came along in the mid to late 90s, I did what everyone else did, which is start a hobby website, which later became Wine Anorak. I think I registered the domain name in 1999, but it had been going for a while already. And it was just, you know, that was what people, we didn't realise how important the internet was and how it was going to change everything up. And so I got, you know, writing about my favourite wines. I started, you know, through work. I remember my first ever vineyard visit was in 96. I went to Australia with work and I went to the Barossa Valley, drove around the coast from Melbourne, hit the Barossa Valley. And that was really interesting for me. I didn't realise you could spit then. So it was...
drunk the whole time. So,
and then what happened is this website started to get some traction. It was a hobby site, but suddenly it got traction. And, you know, I was discussing wine on bulletin boards, which was really interesting. So all these different, geek bulletin boards, the internet brought all the geeks together and people who are really keen on wine. I learned an awful lot just from discussing wine on these bulletin boards. And then I thought, well, you know, I'm a writer, I'm editing books, I'm producing these scientific books. Maybe I should write about wine as well. So I started pitching to editors and they said, yeah, I think the wine world's always been quite welcoming to newcomers, especially when you first emerge. And I got some commissions and then I got a book deal to write a book on wine science. That was in 2004, I think that was. And then in 2005, I got a newspaper column with a national newspaper. And I thought, this is amazing. This is all being done in my spare time. And so in 2008, after 15 years of, you know, commuting to town and working, I quit the day job. And since then, I've just been doing what I do now, which is to write about wine, to lecture, traveling to different wine regions, tasting lots of wines, all from the perspective of a wine geek. And I think that's what's kept it fresh, is because it's something I really enjoy still. I enjoy exploring different wines. And so that's, for me, is great fun.
You probably thought of as a wine professional, but do you still have that amateur enthusiasm that you always had? You still make beautiful new discoveries and are as excited about that as you ever were?
Yeah, totally. This is what's fun for me. And you know, I'm in a really lucky position. I know I make a living doing something I really enjoy without having to do too many things that I don't enjoy. And that's one of the reasons why I try and do what I do, keep things simple. You know, with Wine Anorak, which has been going now for a long time, 26 years, 27 years, it's just me. and I do all the tech stuff. I don't employ people. And it's not because I don't want to employ people. It's just that if I keep it all simple, then my life is much less complicated and I can really concentrate on writing about the sorts of wines I really want to write about, rather than thinking I've got 15 employees and the advertisers aren't interested in supporting weird natural wines from Slovenia. Or, you know, it's like wherever, you know, it's like if somebody makes, you know, 1,000 bottles of something, I can talk about it. I don't need to have something that's relevant to everyone in the world.
And you don't need it signed off by somebody either.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's kind of amateurish, I admit it. But then I think there's enough people out there who are like me, are geeks, who want to read this sort of stuff. And I'm fed up with the mainstream media a bit because it's just too compromised. And so that's my kind of... And then social media came along and so I jumped onto that because I think there's another communication tool. And so I think you have to keep evolving in this business.
And maintain your independence as well, which I think is really important. And what we're trying to talk about here to a certain extent is having ideas which are unfettered rather than conventional for the sake of being conventional.
Mm.
Anyway, Emily, how the hell did you get into wine?
I started working in restaurants actually at quite a young age. So I started waitressing at the age of 15. And by the time I was sort of 17, I was already learning about wine. I was living in Australia in a place called Mandra, which is a couple of hours north of Margaret River. So I was actually visiting winery cellar doors at the age of 17 for kind of fun and doing tastings, slightly illegally.
That's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. So you had such an advantage and be able to do that. My first winery visit was when I was like 29, you know,
yeah, so it's like a... started young. And then by the time I was 18, I was back in the UK. I was working at a restaurant in Reigate, which is very close to where I'm from. Doug's familiar with the restaurant because actually Doug had a big influence on me, which we trace back later on in life, now that we're friends, in my early wine career. Because Le Cave de Perrin, who the company that Doug has been a very big part of for a long time, did the wine list. So I was drinking and tasting wines like Elisabetta Foradori at the age of 18 and Jurin Sansec from Lapierre and these really interesting wines. And sometimes the lunch services were quiet. So I read the portfolio, which this man is behind, which is known as the Bible because it's kind of epic. All these anecdotes and poems and stories and jokes and different things. And I just was like, oh, this is... And it got
more like
me
the satanic verses, actually.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, I got into that. Then it sort of developed into a hobby. I then went to the River Cafe. That's where I kind of cut my teeth in learning about Italian wine. And then by the time I was 21, I was working at Attica. The restaurant manager there had said, oh, you know quite a bit about wine. How do you know that? And I said, oh, you know, I spend all my money on wine and I read a lot of books and I'm just really interested. And she said, well, how about I train you to be a sommelier? Hadn't even considered that as a career path. I just thought wine would be a hobby. And then she put me on some WST courses by 2011. So I was 24 by then. So almost 3 years at Attica. I worked a harvest at Tom Shobrook because he'd come to do a tasting with us at the restaurant. Really loved his wines, loved him as a person, called him up. He got me a job then after I did harvest with him in Italy in Chianti. So I spent 3.5 months working there, came back to the UK, went back to the River Cafe as a sommelier, then at Zeta, which is where you and I run into each other, when I opened Grain Store. Mm.
I remember that. That was Jasmine Hirsch was in town and Mark Andrew was working for Robeson then, and he invited me along. There were about five of us and you were working, and that was when we first met.
Yeah. Which would have been, I don't know, 2014, I think.
Mm.
And then from later on that year, I left the group and then I set up my own consultancy business, Vina Lupa, that I've been running now for coming up to 10 years. Where I do wine consultancy work, so wine education and wineless curation and beverage consultancy now. And then I've been in Berlin for the last 9 years and I have an import business there called Sublime Wine, which is 3 years old. Cool. That's me.
That's very cool. I always admire the way you've got your taste in wine, because your taste is impeccable and I think it spans natural to conventional, but you always seem to manage to spot the really good things. And I guess that when now hearing about your training and everything, you from an early stage, you were exposed to super interesting things at a time when these things were first kind of coming into the market and becoming better known.
Yeah, and kind of getting that whole, like, the kind of growth of natural wine and the boom of natural wine being around for that as well has been really cool. Because it's been a while. Like, so I was, like, 17 years, like, and I'm 36. So it's, like, it's good to get the years in early.
But it was a wonderful energy around that period. And the people you're talking about, Tom Shibroke and Elizabeth of Hardori, they're inspirational people. They're, you know, lovable. They're amazingly intelligent. They're driven in their own particular way, but they inspire other people as well, which is why, you know, I think a lot of people get into wine is they're inspired by someone or even a wine, I guess.
But Doug, what's your story?
Exactly.
I'm really interested. I want to hear your story.
How did you get into wine?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was thinking my first taste of wine was my dad was really interested in sort of classic conventional, you know, Bordeaux and Rioja, particularly old wine. And he used to sort of, after he'd drunk a bottle, he would peel the label off and put it into a scrapbook. And I watched him. I thought, like, it is like the Bible. It's something I just, it's like a Freemasonry that I feel I've got no part of, because I was very young. I didn't really care. And then he'd always give me like the dregs of a bottle, and virtually every bottle he opened had sediment in it. So I'd like be draining the dregs in the most literal sense. And I thought, actually,
Regs Dregs,
which would be the name of.
Should we rename the podcast Regs Dregs?
That's the after-hours version.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the name of my autobiography, which I haven't written yet, because I'll probably lose it anyway. And then I didn't really think about wine for a long time until my mum and a friend of hers bought a restaurant in South Kensington said, "Oi, do you want to look after the wine list?" And I said, "But I know nothing."
What stage are you? What age were you at this? You weren't probably 14 years old at school.
I certainly wasn't at school. There was post university, so I was probably.
Where did you study at university?
A little known place called Oxford.
You went to Oxford, and what do you study?
I studied when pubs closed. I studied English literature.
Fantastic.
And I think the only thing I've used English literature for is actually to help me describe my feelings about wines. And I certainly didn't use it very much at the time to help me through a degree. But I think through reading a lot and sort of subconsciously absorbing what I'd read and finding a pure love of language, which, again, as I say, I didn't really use at the time in sort of analytical essays about novels or poems or whatever. But now I find, weirdly enough, you know, in retrospect, that it was really useful to have done a degree. Yeah. I never would have said so afterwards.
So let's go back to the restaurant in, so post-university, South Kensington, mother opens a restaurant.
Mother opens a restaurant.
What sort of restaurant was it?
What do you call it? Modern European, I guess, English influence. Very, very simple, very small restaurant, 30 covers. And the chef was doing the wine list before, and she won for the wine list the Egan Rennie Award for the best London wine list, and then, which is pretty good, good accolade, I think. And then she said, "Now it's yours." And I thought, you know, I know nothing. And I didn't have time to study, so I had to literally teach myself out of books. And I had some mentors, people like Jasper Morris, was like, you know, he was a close friend of the restaurant. And I think he taught me quite a bit. I loved his sort of like, you know, it was like youthful enthusiasm, I guess. And next year I won the award, and then recession hit. I had to go to another restaurant where I became a sort of more formal sommelier, again without any training, so I wasn't really formal at all. I was the sort of person who'd open an expensive bottle, sit down at the table and say, "Plead, give me some of this." And I managed to taste some of the, you know, the finest wines known to humanity, to coin a phrase, you know, Bordeaux from the 80s, early 80s, Burgundy from the 70s and 60s, and California from the 70s. I mean, some great, great labels. Mm. And it made me think, do you know what? There's wine, and then there's wine, you know, fine wine. And I appreciated why a Cheval Blanc 82 might be given a spurious number of points, because it was absolutely beautiful and hedonistic. And again, it just excited and ignited in a passion for wine. And I won the same award there as I did in the other restaurants. So I thought, well, maybe it's me, or maybe it isn't. I mean, but I thought that maybe I was good at putting together a wine list of wines that I really loved. And that's what was being recognised. And then thereafter, I'd flirted both sides. You know, I was mainly a manager, front of house sort of type person, until one year. I think it was, can't remember when it was. Was in the 90s, I guess. I literally burnt out. I was working 80 to 100 hour weeks, and the thing I loved about work was selling wine to customers on the floor. But I was a general manager, and I didn't have that luxury of sort of talking at tables. And so I joined the other side, and the other side was one of the suppliers to the restaurant where I was working, and that was, as Emily alluded to earlier, Les Caves de Pirenne, a very tiny little company of four people based out in Guildford, which specialised purely in the wines of the southwest France, of Gascony and the Pyrenees, hence Les Caves de Pirenne. And I didn't really see this as, you know, a job for life, but I'm still there 28 years later. And life has changed. I mean, now, you know, at one point, with the restaurants, associated restaurants we opened and people we employed in them, and the growth of the company and sister companies that we opened in Spain and Italy and Australia, we were employing 150 people across the world, from starting from a base of four without any investment. So we grew organically. And I guess the turning point, other than not going bust around the millennium, the turning point was just before 2008, when we had the idea to open Terroir, which was going to be the first, effectively, natural wine bar in the UK. And natural wine was just becoming a phenomenon in Paris, and, you know, France is where it was born, I guess, in the movement that we associate nowadays. And we were a bit taken by natural wine bars and caves in Paris, and then we opened Terroir in 2008. And it was, I guess, a phenomenon. You know, no one had treated wine in this sort of relatively unpretentious way before. We were pouring wines that no one had ever seen in this country before. The wines looked weird, smelt weird, tasted weird, but people were enchanted, because I think the public particularly, but also the trade, were really wanted something novel. They wanted to give it a go. And then, of course, after a while, it becomes the political football. And we got a lot of kickback from journalists in particular, who thought the whole thing was a sort of, I don't know, like almost like an advertising phenomenon. It was like, you know, a bandwagon that we had jumped upon, but we hadn't jumped upon it. We, you know, this is what we love to drink, and we just wanted others to like to drink in the same way. So I guess, to cut a long story short, I mean, we're still there. In 2023, we're a much more professional company. We ship from 22 countries around the world, and we champion natural wines, but we don't feel we have to call them natural. We just call them wines. And, you know, if they're made with low intervention.
This is an interesting point, Doug, because I think that people get their knickers in a twist about natural wines. You say, by calling your wines, you're calling our wines unnatural. And but the problem is, I don't see many people saying they make natural wine. Yeah, there's a fair that's a natural wine fair, and lots of people go to it and share their wines. So it's like a club, a group of people who get together and share the wines. And there seems to be a, you know, if you go into a town and there's a bar that's a natural wine bar or something, then you know the sorts of wines you're going to find. But you pick up the bottle. No one's put in a bottle natural wine. I think the only one that I can think of, that they claim to be natural wine, when Philip Cox from Cremel Reques did a natural orange wine. And it put the word natural on the label. And it's like everyone else is saying, well, you need to define what natural wine is. And it's like, oh, guys, but it's all going very well. This is actually a sector of the wine industry that's strong. You go to a natural wine fair and you see young people enjoying wine. So why do you suddenly need to want to regulate it and get it defined? And it's control. And I think the other thing is, the only people who want definition of natural wine are the big companies. So they can say, well, you've defined natural wine. I've just made this wine according to your definition. Therefore, it's natural wine. So they can kind of, like the big brewers when they buy a craft brewery, and they say, well, we're making craft beer. And it's like, there's this almost like a lot of noise. And I think you just have to ignore it.
It's an interesting point, though, because what comes to mind when you say that to me is I think the whole idea of, I mean, it's very much a systemic topic at the moment, right? Like, the freedom for, the freedom to, like this idea of regulation being something that helps us. But does it actually help us? Because actually, in many cases, if we start regulating it, isn't that going to inhibit the creative aspect of a lot of these producers?
And some of, no, not the other way around, some of the strong communicators of natural wine say really horrible things about people like me. It's like, and I'm friends with them, we'll shake hands with them, we'll meet them. And then later on, you see them saying things like, that I'm supporting the chemical industry and things, you know, because I'm not fully in the camp. You know, it's this idea that it's like, if I didn't go to church at all, it would be fine. But if I go to church 2 weeks out of four and then the other 2 weeks go somewhere
else.
You're
not serious about it.
It's almost then suddenly they're angry with you. But at least I'm going twice a month, you know, this is better than nothing, isn't it? And then, no, it's not. You're either fully in or you're fully out. And so that becomes a little fractious. I remember doing a talk with Doug at a wine fair, and I got there and I saw these leaflets with my name on my picture. I thought, wow, this is amazing. Well done, thanks, Doug. You've put some publicity out for me. And then we were halfway through the thing, and I picked it up, and it was like someone had gone to the trouble. This is the really fantastic thing of doing a full colour thing, telling everyone why I was really bad.
Whilst I was presenting,
oh, was it? Oh, guys, look, I'm, you know, and then I really, oh, right, okay.
No.
But it's like they'd also not just gone to the trouble of doing like an A4 sheet. They'd done an A4 sheet and then guillotined it in half. And it was like, that's a lot of effort to go to. And I kind of felt flattered. But it was weird as well. It's like, I mean, seriously, I'm okay. So maybe I sometimes say that it's not a terrible thing to use cultured yeasts. It might be for some producers an interesting way of, you know, they might find their terroir signatures clearer because they used a cultured yeast. I'm not saying always, or not saying this is necessary. I'm saying we can't discount that possibility. You know, I've visited some really good producers and I've seen their cellars, like lovely old foodras and everything. And then they said, well, we did use cultured yeast because when we did wild ferments, we lost our terroir a bit. The wine's blurred at the edges. So I think we should think about this sometimes. But then it's heresy for some people. I can understand that wild yeast is part of wine, and the idea of adding cultured yeast, even if they're yeast that have been selected from nature, is unthinkable to them. That's fine. But I think we have to be careful we don't go on a crusade to persecute people who have different ideas.
And maybe that also is a nice segue into like the point we wanted to make around the format of this podcast.
Yeah.
Right? Like steering away from maybe a very dogmatic viewpoint. We're already illustrating.
Yes. No, well, I think it's being open-minded and thoughtful and you know, I think we all kind of like the same sorts of wines, right?
Mm.
But we all come from slightly different perspectives. And that's a richness, I think.
Oh, totally. I mean, I was going to say one good, one bad thing about wine, but I don't need to anymore. I think what you touched on is really important. I always think, you know, who controls the controllers and everything? And when there was an attempt, we'll go back to natural wine. We'll use an example, even though this is not necessarily the topic we're talking about today, but we've chanced upon it. And there are associations that have tried to control the definition of natural wine. And, you know, for the best of all reasons, is they don't want people cashing in and calling their wines natural when they're not. So they put down, you know, measurements, et cetera, and, you know, you should do this, you should do that, and you need to be inspected. Okay, fair enough. But then we work with a grower who is very much, you know, climbed on board that and works in all the sort of like low intervention ways. And then he's saying like, you know, I have to pay to get an organic certificate. Then I have to pay to get a Demeter certificate. Now I have to get a Van Nature certificate and pay for that. And he said, you know, I just want to make wine, you know. And of course, he'll make natural wine as natural as anybody. But the fact that someone is like checking up on you, it's almost like they're spying on you. This is not the spirit of wine. And when we started the Real Wine Fair, another little part of our lives, we deliberately did not put together a manifesto. Not that I criticise other wine fairs for having manifestos, but we felt that we should have an understanding that growers work in a particular spirit. And some may be at the end of the journey of low intervention, and some may be in the middle, and some may be at the beginning. But as far as we're concerned, they're a family because they come to the fair and they participate in it. We didn't want anyone, you know, criticizing anyone else and say, well, yeah, a bit like your example, yeah, but they use a pierre de cuve, like a starter,
starter
yeast or whatever, or, you know, they do cold ferments, or they do, like, you know, not a tangential filtration or whatever it might be. These are relevant points. We're talking about the wine itself and the farming and the feel and the intention behind it, which is to give pleasure. And I think, well, I like to believe that in the Real Wine Fair and in the work that my company have done, we embrace diversity. Of course, we want the spirit of terroir and the place and the person behind it. It's all part of a complex equation that makes wine the way it is. We're not dogmatic, but we've been painted as dogmatic because we're associated with some spurious movement, which isn't even a movement, called natural wine. It's an amorphous idea that a lot of people got behind. And that's what annoys me about wine, is that you're either in one camp or you're in another. And you can't just be reasonable and rational and, you know... And it ends up having arguments with people you've never met before, often, and they're criticizing you for things that you never said or believe. So the wine world is as, like, fragile in that respect as every other political entity, you know, because people feel that they have to create a position and get behind it, and then they'll be renowned for creating the position, regardless of whether they actually believe it or not sometimes. And so, you know, I'm not afraid to have a few stramashes, as we say in Scotland, you know, a few sort of verbal arguments, because I think it can be healthy to get these things out in the open. But what I don't like is a lot of it is done behind the scenes on social media. You read a criticism, you think, where did that come from? So
it's quite interesting, though, how the words natural wine, those two words have become so polarizing, right? Like how... it can be almost inflammatory for some people to, like, kick off quite a heated debate. Natural wine.
But it means vague. I mean, wine, we understand, but natural, it's got the connotations of something morally positive. So all wine which is not natural is unnatural. But no, it's conventional, it's classical. You know, it's like a period of poetry. You know, it's like romantic poetry versus classical poetry versus modernistic poetry. We're just saying natural wine is low intervention. We could call it that. I don't think anything is a satisfactory term, because language is naturally, you know, like, vague or weak or has holes in it. But it's become an emotional term, because people don't make natural wines feel resentful that their wines are not being considered as, like, morally positive. Whereas I don't believe that in one bit, because natural wine is like 2% or 1% of the world market. It's not, like, that important. But it's important to the people who make it, and it's important to the people who drink it and sell it. So it is a legitimate force. And whether you think it's a force for good or a force for evil, that's entirely your perspective.
So part of what we're going to do in this podcast is taste wine.
I think we should crack it open because it's a bit weird to be talking about
it. We've
got
one to taste that Doug brought along, actually.
Yes.
Which is we'll describe for the benefit of those listening on radio. It's a very interestingly packaged wine. So it's got an artistic label, which is a piece of art of two people without definable heads hugging, I think. That's what I see there.
There's
hearts embracing. Yes. And then what you see is a level of the ground level, and underneath is all these roots.
They almost look like octopus tentacles as well.
But it's a lightweight bottle with a simple screw cap without any detail on the capsule. So that's kind of basic.
The arch label, though, like, don't you think there's something that reminds me of a bit of a churchy vibe with that, like a bit like an altar or a church window?
Yes, no, good point. Yes. Yeah.
A stained glass window, something.
And on the back we have... just as Stajeska Slovenia, so that's part of Slovenia, isn't it? Near towards...
yes.
That includes Halozaya area. Styria.
Styria. Yeah.
And it's Lasky Riesling from Zorjan.
Yes.
So shall I open it? You can tell us what it is as I open it. Oh, sound the screw cap unscrewing.
Well, who said crazy pouring Slovenian wine? Someone did early on.
Yes.
For those that get a kick out of hearing the sound of wine being poured.
And as we point in the glass, you see this is a sort of golden hue.
Yes.
Yellow golden colour, I think I'd call that.
Can we say cheers? Are we cheersing?
Yes, we can.
Cheers, yeah. Cheers.
You can say whatever we like. It's a podcast.
And
keep it clean though.
Quite clear. Not cloudy, but not totally clear.
Yes.
Tell us about Zorjan.
Osador Zorjan. So, a total disciple of Steiner, but actually Goethe, and before that. So, pre-biodynamics, if you like. Systems of farming, single farm with the sort of animals, you know, as part of the farm.
When it says permanent agriculture, it's like permaculture. Is that why that says that on the back?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's using all the animals. Yeah. And but for me, this is something to do with, this is like wine and mysticism. He's very much believer in sort of like almost like the mystical forces, and the root systems, those like octopus tentacles that Emily referred to, they are the deep root systems you get when you farm organically and biodynamically, and you get like incredibly complex root systems which are obviously searching for water and nutrients in the soil, and then interconnecting and passing sort of yeasts and sort of almost like micro bacterial knowledge up the vine and into the wine eventually, we would hope.
What soil is the
Some local sort of volcanic mix of soils.
It's quite salty, isn't it? The wine?
It's really saline. Mm.
We're about
and four, is this skin fermented?
Sorry?
Skin fermented?
It has time in the skins. But the colour is deceptive because all their wines are super amber, and some of them have like 10 days skin contact and some of them have 6 months. But normally what they do is when they crush the grapes, they want as much oxygen into the wine as possible. I mean, so basically the juice starts brown, really brown, and then sort of naturally clarifies. And they either use Georgian clay pots, Kvevri, or occasionally Croatian clay pots, or big Slovenian barrels, and sort of stabilizes over time. I mean, this is 2016. It was the vintage that we were getting like last year or the year before.
This is 2016.
Yeah, I couldn't see the vintage on the label actually. But.
I don't think any earthly responsibilities.
Yeah. What, it's very fresh still. Isn't
yeah, it is.
For a wine that's 8 years old, this is fresh. It's mineral and salty. It's textural. It's not just about fruit.
Yeah,
Fruit's fine, but it's that other stuff underneath that fruit. That
but there's also some quite botanical notes, almost like a little bit of clove on the nose.
Very medicinal.
Yeah.
Some green tea.
Yeah,
definitely. It's got a wonderful bitterness, which I love, because I find that quite refreshing. The interesting thing is the old labels had, or the new labels, sorry, have in the back of the bottle. I don't think this one does. It tells you the serving temperature, which should be over, I think it's over 16 degrees.
And which is probably what it is right now, right? Like this.
Yeah. So the warmer it gets.
This is a little warmer than it. When we started talking, it was probably at about 8, reckon. Now I think it's probably about 14.
Yeah. The warmer it gets, the better it gets. The more it's sort of the palate broadens, the more complex layers you begin to sort of, your tongue begins to taste. The other thing is on the new labels, they have like a little mobile phone and then a circle and a cross. So like, do not have mobile phones.
They're the ones
phones.
I've seen. Keep your mobile phones away from this.
That's right. Yes. And it's for
because
two reasons.
Is that about the EMFs?
It's two things. It could be about
electromagnetic frequencies. Yeah,
could be that. But they also say that if you look at your mobile phone, you're not focused on the wine, which is true, of course. So it's a humorous and one quite serious thing. But this guy believes in, you know, Orgones. Have you heard of these things, Jamie? This is guy invented, I think in the, I can't remember when it was, in the States. You know the Kate Bush song, Cloud Busting?
Yes.
Have you ever heard that?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's about an Orgone. The guy invented this device that could control the weather. A bit like all-American Trump Republicans.
A device
belief.
That can control the weather.
Yes, yeah. And that's, and basically...
All I can say is...
Yeah,
if you can
create storms, can't you? And make it rain, basically. That's...
Yeah, well, if that worked, it's incredibly selfish to hold on to a device like this and not to go to places.
But I think it does work.
Not
it does
to go
work.
To,
no,
not,
like, it's actually
go to drought-prone areas and get some rain for them. You know.
Okay. This is a little anecdote I'm going to throw into there. So he's talking about the Orgone, and he only speaks Croatian. So Slovenian. So the person he was with was translating, looking more and more puzzled as Bosidar, Soljan went on and on and on. And the guy who created the Orgone was supposedly assassinated by the FBI. And in the cloud-busting song by Kate Bush, this whole thing is repeated.
Because big business has got too much to lose.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway...
How big is an Orgone?
It's like a big pipe, like it could be from the ceiling in your room, so maybe 10 foot tall.
Huh?
And you point it at the sky, you point it at the clouds, and the idea is that...
Have you ever seen one, Doug?
He has one.
He has one?
Yeah.
And so what did you ask for?
I asked for a sunny summer in 2024, and it never happened.
We all asked for it, Doug.
Yes, but he was too far away, you know. Yeah. This is a guy who gets his active sulfur... sulfur to spray on his vines from Etna, because that's the nearest volcano to Slovenia. Active volcano.
How do you harvest sulfur from an active volcano?
I don't know. Maybe someone sells it. It's a good business to be in.
It's a niche business, let's say that. So, but what...
Okay, so the Orgone. So use the Orgone so that they didn't... You know, they have a lot of hailstorms. They're high up in the mountains. They're 450 metres. And obviously vines, if they're struck by hail, you know, it's a disaster for the grapes. So I think he does something with the Orgone so that the hailstorm passes by.
It hits the neighbour.
So
fucks up there. Sorry.
Yeah.
Screws up there, can't harvest.
It's okay, we'll leave that in. Anyway, so next day, the same day, we go and visit a grower called Andreas Chepper, who you both know.
Yes, like, yeah.
And we were trying to describe to him Bosidor's Orgone and like this like weird conspiracy theory and how it works. He said, "Oh yeah, I know about the Orgone." He said, "Like, yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?" We said, yes. He said, "I've got one." I use it. He said, "When I go away on holiday, I like leave it pointing in the sky. I have no idea whether it works." And I just thought, that's so brilliant. That's so sort of like, it's so like in the biodynamics is again, it's about like being there and feeling it and using voodoo science and, you know, voodoo to do something and just having faith in it. And it's amazing how often it works, but it may just be like fluke, of course, but it's fun. It's part of the story of wine.
Well, anyway. Ultimately, the proof is in the glass.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is astonishing. First of all, for this variety to be producing a wine that tastes like this after 8 years, but also this is a new way of thinking and drinking, I think. You know, people who are technically trained on fruity, you know, modern techno wines would be resistant to these wines, because it's not that they're faulty, it's just they're different. And the emphasis here is not on bright fruit aromatics, it's on how do you feel the wine in the mouth and what's the texture, what's the acid line, you know. And it's a sort of wine that dances in your perceptions. It's like it's not static in your perceptions. And this is what I love about these sorts of wines. They reward attention. So I take this wine, I look at it, I taste it. Knowing where it comes from as well helps, I think, because that sort of knowledge can actually inform your tasting and guide your tasting. But this is just, you know, who would have thought that a wine would be like this after 8 years?
Well, and here's the rub of the whole thing. So wine born in oxygen lives in oxygen. The more air it gets, it doesn't collapse, which is what we associate with so many wines. Right. It strengthens the wine.
Yeah.
And here's another anecdote. Is that when I show the wines to people in restaurants, they say, "Well, I can't coravin it because it's got a capsule." And I said, "You don't need to coravin it.
Yeah,
in fact, you can have it open for 5 weeks." And we've done experiments with the Zorian wines and some of Worcester and Chepin and whatever. You leave them open, they get better and better. But, you know, like they're so strong, because even if they're pressed straight, there's still phenolics in the juice. There's phenolics in this to the nth degree. They're not like coarse or clumsy. They're a lovely sort of granular texture, which they give the wine. And I think the wine is so strong. You know, this is why, you know, it doesn't taste old.
Thank you.
The colour, you know, is if anything, the colour's dropping out. It seems to be brighter, you know, than it ever has been, you know. And I think wines develop... When I read a science book, I remember... and it said, basically, as soon as you open the wine, it oxidizes. And I think that's like quite a weird thing to say, because it implies that The wine caramelizes, it goes, it dies. It's the first stage of death. But this wine, the longer it's open, the more life it has. It's almost like wisdom, you know, like a...
No, this is very interesting because obviously my background was in science and so I became very interested in wine science. And my understanding of wine science is incomplete because I found that there are some wines where there is... No, this is a term we're not supposed to use, mineral. Right. Some wines where they're oxidatively handled early on, they build up this mineral presence and then... Somehow this mineral presence in the wine is protecting that wine from deterioration. It's got this almost...
resiliency.
Resilience in the wine. Mm. And actually, very interestingly, not a more conventional wine, but I opened a bottle about 6 weeks ago, I opened a bottle of Chateau Soudereau, so Sauterne, from 2017, so quite a young Sauterne. And I left it in the fridge with two-thirds of it drunk. We had drunk it one night. And I forgot about it and left it for 6 weeks. Went back to it, fresh as a daisy. You know, not shown any noticeable deterioration. And so some wines, it's not like it's an oxidised wine. You wouldn't say Sauterne is an oxidised wine style. It's not. It's fresh and fruity and really delicious. But something about those wines that kind of makes them a little bit bomb-proof.
Yeah.
To oxygen. And I think that this is a sort of wine that... As you say, you could put the cap back on this, and I'm sure it would be really interesting.
How long do you think it would be until mainstream wine education updates itself? Because I feel like what you've just described with the interaction with certain customers, the assumption that's there because if they've read maybe a book that was written in the 90s by so-and-so, that's kind of this wine education that's kind of regurgitated over and over in like a bunch of different books. When do you think that changes and how does that change?
I think it does change. So a couple of years ago, I was asked to write a paper on natural wine for the WSET for their diploma that they were doing. And I got Doug to help me out a bit here. I think we were looking at the one of the things they wanted to know is what's the extent of the natural wine market? You know, how big is it?
Yeah.
And Doug did some sort of back of the... what was the old term they used to use? The back of the cigarette packet, wasn't it? Where they used to... what's the term? Not that you smoke or I smoke.
Yeah, exactly. So yes.
Or that anyone's really smoking anymore. Yes.
Back of the fag packet calculations.
Yeah, what the chancellors do.
I love those old terms. And came up with an interesting figure. But see the WSET teaching the diploma, these wine educational, that there seems to be an openness to new things. Like last year, one of the dissertation topics for the diploma was on regenerative viticulture. So that's cool. They're kind of keeping up with it, you know. So that was good for me because I sold quite a lot of books to WSET level 4 students. I think the wine world, it has an openness now that maybe it didn't have in the past. And I think we're seeing everything in the past was kind of defined by kind of the English fine wine trade, you know. So like when in the UK we're very Francocentric, and I know Emily you've gained a lot of expertise in Italy. My Italian expertise is just starting now. I'm taking an interest in Italy and it's an amazing country for wine. But I was kind of led to believe that France was the main country for fine wine, and I think that's changing. I think the natural wine movement, even though it's not a movement, even though it's like an alliance of like-minded people, I've seen that grow from very little. When I was on the bulletin boards back in, say, maybe 2000, 2001, we were just having the first sort of like reactions to natural wine that was happening. I remember discussing with Frank Cornelison, who'd been out at an event, he said, and where they'd drunk 5 litres a head of natural wine because there were no sulfites, he had no headache the next day. These sorts of discussions were happening, and Joe Dressner was active on the boards, you know, he was a famous importer. Natural wines into the New York market, and it went from being incredibly niche and tiny and quite exciting to being something that actually, you know, got to be mainstream, not in terms of the wines really hitting everywhere, but just everyone becoming aware of it. And I think one of the big events that I think I remember, that really kicked things off was in 2011 in Borough Market, which was the first real wine fair. Mm.
And it was called the Natural Wine Fair.
We called it the Natural Wine Fair in those days. Yeah, yeah. For one-off, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was really a pivotal moment, I think.
I think 2011 was a seminal year for... There was also...
Is that when Terroirs opened in 11 or was that 10?
No, we opened Terroir in 2008. So that's natural eight. Wine was a okay, thing. Yeah. But 2011, I think the Natural Wine Fair, because there were 120 growers and because there are thousands of people from natural wine lovers to total skeptics and the whole of journalism and people from other countries were so curious to see what it was all about. There was an underlying element of controversy as well, where we had quite a few negative articles, some very positive ones in newspapers, and some seminars that were frothing, with bile, shall we say. I know, I was at the one where, I was chairing the one where it went a bit pear-shaped.
What happened? Go on, tell us.
So, an MW... Spare her blushes... sitting in the audience, and she said, "I've just tasted like every wine out there, and they're all oxidized."
Really?
And I was
during the seminar.
This is the beginning of the seminar.
That's who is that?
I can't tell you because she's still around. And I was being
famous. Tell us after.
Scale of 1 to 10, how famous? Like 10 being the most.
You've
famous.
All heard of her,
yeah. Right? Right. Okay.
I won't say more. But I was sitting, I was chairing the panel and feeling fairly ambient and trying, not to provoke fights or get involved in them. And I just sat up, bolt upright and said, "Sorry, what do you mean? All the wines are oxidized." She said, "Yeah, they are. They're all." And I said, I couldn't think of what to say. I said, "Did you mention this to the growers?" And I said, hold on a minute, what are you saying? I said, they're not, I've tasted the wines out there, and I know the wines pretty well. I said, "Do you mean oxidative in style or in terms of the winemaking?" He said, "No, oxidized." I said, "No, there's a difference." I said, "You're an MW, you should know. One is making wine with, oxygen and big barrels and not topping up and getting secondary aromatics, goodness knows, you can make an Oloroso, that's oxidative. Van Jaune is not, I thought, why am I telling someone whose livelihood, who's written books on wine, what it's all about, me, a relative novice?" And there was a sense of animosity in the room on both sides, I think. There were very much the antis and me, the pros. And in hindsight, I would say, it isn't such a Manichaean thing. It's okay, you don't like the wines, but don't dismiss them. Don't dismiss the livelihoods of 120 people.
Entitlement, almost, yeah. And to think that you own wine because you were expensively educated, yeah. That you sometimes have an inside track and everyone else here has got to... Your perspective is the true perspective.
The final word belongs to you.
But you're right about... That's fighting talk, really.
Yes, it's fighting talk. But it reminded me that wine is... traditional wine is a hierarchy. It's the opinions of the... What do you call them? Chatterati, but the people who write books and are wine educators and make expensive wine brands, they are at the peak, and then we who like sort of more humble wines are at the bottom. But of course, it's flipped, because if you think about certain wine regions, say Beaujolais, say Jura, say the Loire, just for starters, the best winemakers are natural winemakers, yeah. I humbly submit. And therefore, it's odd, because when you say, "Hey, do you drink natural wines?" "No, I don't drink it because I've had a bad experience once." I said, "Yeah, but do you drink, Lapierre or Foyard or, Joly or whoever it might be, I don't know." And they said, "Oh, yeah, I drink those wines." I said, "Well, they're natural."
No, so, I know, this amuses me to a point, because I remember one notable colleague predicted in 2013, this would be the year, New Year prediction, this will be the year natural wine fails and finishes. Yep. It's a flash in the pan. And this particular individual has an Instagram feed, and whenever they travel to these regions, who are the producers being featured? It's the natural dudes. It's and you almost want to go on there and say, "Great to see you love natural wine, but that's too..."
Then you're a bit like the person that made the flyer, yeah. Jamie.
No, you should just be grateful that people I actually realised that, oh, well, maybe these wines are the most interesting wines from a particular region. And this is one going, this is maybe a digression. It's one thing frustrating about Austria. I love going to the single vineyard summit and everything. But the problem is in Austria, you've got some really fine wines that fit into that single vineyard summit, the conventionally made ones. Mm. But then the really exciting things in Austria are being ignored. And they can't even use the name of the region.
But is that not political again? Because isn't it about who's paid? Do people pay into that?
No, it's not just about paying in. It's because there are certain rules to do with this new sort of
vinification or,
you know, single vineyard sort of classification, okay, where to even use the appellation name, let alone single vineyard name, you need to filter your wines, for instance.
Yes.
You know, it's like, well, come on, guys.
Work with our Austrian producer in Kamptal, and he used to call his wine Grüneveltliner from Strassetal, which is the name of the village, region. He had to take, as soon as he stopped filtering, I asked him not to filter the wine because it tasted 10 times better unfiltered. He had to take off Strasse, where he came from. Then it became like Landwein, table wine. Then it was Grüneveltliner unfiltered. He wasn't allowed to use that. And now it's called handcrafted. Because
no, it's a whole country is like almost like they're hampering the marketing of that country because of this insistence on some rules from.
Is the argument on filtration that having an unfiltered wine is going to obscure that terroir? Is that what the argument for that in that world is?
Ultimately, there may be justifications, but ultimately, again, we're seeing a struggle for control.
Yeah,
and a way of thinking, a way of doing things that can't. Is threatened by these people, especially the Styrians. You go to Caractère and you see these amazing wines. You see the Styrian tables being mobbed.
Yes.
Because everyone loves them so much.
These are some of the best wines you'll ever taste.
But it goes back to that sentence that you said before around who's controlling the controllers, right? Yes. Like, what's the forces at work?
Well, I think ultimately this is a degree of insecurity because you've got an aesthetic system that's there, which is this what we may call fine wine. It's an aesthetic system, and you see like variations on it. So you might see the fine wine aesthetic system in a London fine wine merchant. It might be different to if you travel to Napa or the USA, where Americans consider like a lot of these very expensive Napa wines to be, you know, in the peer group and as good as and as sought after as top Bordeaux, for instance, and they'll pay hundreds of dollars a bottle for that. So there's a slight variation, but they're still within the larger overall aesthetic system of fine wine. Then you have something coming in where you've got what we call natural wine, where suddenly it's like a let's begin to learn again. And some people find that threatening because they think they've learned everything, they know everything, and suddenly we're learning again. It's like, are we learning to see terroir as expressed, for instance, through skin fermented whites? Everyone says orange wines taste the same. Well, that's a ridiculous thing to say because red wines are skin fermented, and they don't taste the same.
Yeah.
Orange wines are skin fermented, you know, amber wines, whatever you want to call them, skin fermented whites, don't all taste the same. It's just that we're not experienced at trying to understand the way that terroir manifests itself.
But it's also
through these different wine styles. So it's like, and I think it's very exciting from my point of view because we will get to learn again together what it's like to suddenly say, we'll have a cloudy wine. That's not a bad thing necessarily. Yeah. You know, it's like we'll have a wine that's a red wine that's juicy and light and pale, yet profound.
The weird thing was we'd learned through this sort of like system that, you know, to respect certain things and say this is right and this is wrong. Going to the orange thing, which we'll discuss in another podcast, I remember the late, great Mike Wirsing, American, made the most phenomenal Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs in Canterbury.
Pyramid Valley.
Pyramid Valley, yeah. Yeah. And
we were discussing Mike today. With some very highly regarded New Zealand producers and mentioned some of the. Actually, I was with Nick Mills of Ripon, and he was talking about texture in wine and how you understand terroir not from the fruit, but you understand it from other things.
Yeah.
And I remember Mike talking about this a lot. And Mike was a profound, and it didn't end well for Mike, sadly. But
he was a profound thinker
about wine.
Yeah, I mean, he was very into the idea of phenolics, and whether or not he did skin contact in his wine, he would say
It takes 2 years, 3 years to make a wine. But the wine, the vineyard, the wine is deriving its, you know, terroir and its nourishment from the vineyard, and it's using it to ripen grapes and, like, you know, increase the volume of the juice and so on and so forth. What do? I press the grapes. I just get juice. What happens to the skins and the stems and everything? That's part of the terroir. Mm-hmm. If I lose the phenolics, I lose the terroir. So he said, like, therefore, I love phenolics. You know, I love texture. This is what makes wine what it is. But it's so odd that people who talk about, like, clean skin wine or just, like, juice, that's sulfured and clarified and clean. It's sort of clean in an antiseptic way, and it presents fruit. It doesn't present anything underneath the fruit.
Mm.
Well, I submit. I mean, of course, and there are relative cases, but phenolics is never a bad thing. But if you, I just recently wrote a blog on Riesling, and I said, I don't like incredibly clean Riesling. I understand that's the way most people perceive Riesling to be, is like zingy and citrusy, but I like more texture. And if it means slow pressing or not filtering or even doing a little bit of cold maceration on the skins, I don't think it has to be muddied up necessarily, but I do like something to bite into because that's the way I like my wines. And I was hoping for a little bit of kickback on this because I was writing it to be slightly controversial, but no one reads my blog, so that was okay. That was never going to happen. but I think that certain things.
Are we dwelling in self pity city a little bit?
Though? We are.
Self pity city.
Yeah. Look, I'm just trying to drum up some business. You know me.
I've read your blog.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, as I say, this was more of a. I felt it was a controversial subject because I know people worship Riesling, and they really do. Therefore, the grape variety must be, you know, within the box, you know, otherwise it isn't true to the grape variety. But I don't believe in the grape variety. I believe in terroir. I believe in the place. I believe in the decisions made at the time. And I believe a lot in texture, like Mike and like so many other, you know, like great growers, and that wines don't always have to taste the same. A classic example is Alexandre Bain in the Loire. Someone who makes pre-fumé that basically, in the end, it got kicked out for being not typical. But you could be making the only typical pre-fumé, and everybody else can be making a facsimile of it, the style, which has now only been popular for the last 20 or 30 years. Basically, early harvested, fermented in stainless, clarified, sulfured, cold settled, no mallow, blah, 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 everything. And he does the opposite. And he does the opposite in the way that his grandfather did. You know, everyone used wooden barrels. Everyone harvested late because they had polyculture. Everyone wild fermented. Everyone did, all the wines used to do mallow, probably. They weren't filtered, they weren't fined, and they weren't sulfured. They come up with something like we're drinking with this Lasky Riesling, and someone would say, that is not Sauvignon. To which I would say, you mean us green, herbaceous, grassy, underripe, sulfured wine. And yeah, I've had again discussions, shall we say, animated discussions with MWs and wine teachers, or whatever you call wine, people teach wine courses. And they say, no, Sauvignon, it has to be recognisably cat's pea in a gooseberry bush style. Otherwise, consumers won't understand it. I think, like, this is nothing to do with the wine, is it, really? It's, you're making a product with a specific purpose of selling something which is a brand. Whereas if you love wine and you make wine, you farm grapes, you want to make the best you possibly can, then you're going to make an Alexandre Bain style.
Because this is a very good point, Doug. And I'm hopefully, dear listeners, you can realise at the moment that we have a lot of material that we are just desperate to talk about. But I think we've come more or less to the end of this first introductory episode of Just Another Wine Podcast.
We should pick this up, though. It'd be interesting getting into this.
We have got a really exciting list of topics that we're going to explore over coming episodes.
Which include...
We have left some room, but some things will be...
I think the next one we're going to talk about is your faults, my flaws. And we've touched on this already.
That sounds like a self-help sort of thing, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Doug, tell me.
your troubles.
Let me lie down on
dear
that.
Dear Doug.
On your lovely
dear
couch.
Dear Doug, I have a problem. Is it a problem?
Dear Doug, yeah.
Is it a problem?
Yeah. I think we are now exactly at 1 hour, which is perfectly long enough for the first episode. So it remains for us to each say goodbye and looking forward to connecting again in episode 2
very soon.
We're looking forward to seeing you next time. You can find us on our Instagram at Just Another Wine Podcast. Thanks for listening.
That was natural.